Okay. Hi, everyone. My name is Levi. I'm an alcoholic. This is an open meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. An open meeting about the Atlanta Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. It is our belief that our meeting structure is necessary to maintain the integrity of the group so that it may better carry the message of AA. And since the most important aspect of AA recovery is one alcoholic relating to another, only alcoholics participate. It is our primary problem, if your primary problem. Yeah, it's a nice little slip in there. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. Our literature persons, Destina and Kobe, exactly, have the list of such groups with their phone numbers. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and or your understanding. John will read the preamble.
Evening, I'm John. I'm an alcoholic. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other so that they may solve their common problem and help others recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is the desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting for our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics achieve sobriety.
Thank you for that. Please join in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Excellent. Joel will read the steps.
I'm Joel, and I'm an alcoholic. 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. 1, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. 2, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. 3, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. 4, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. 5, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. 6, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. 7, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. 8, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9, made direct amends to such people whenever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we try to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Jennifer will read the traditions.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Jennifer. I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. The 12 traditions. 1, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. 2, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. 3, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. 4, each group should be autonomous, except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. 5, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. 6, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. 7, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9, AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10. Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues. Hence, the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. And 12. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers followed by our information break, and then our main speaker who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker is Jeff.
Hi, I'm Jeff. I'm an alcoholic. My home group is the Atlantic Group. My sponsor's name is John. My sobriety date is August 9th of 2005, and I am currently working on steps 9 through 12. So, let's see, I guess I'll try and tell you in a general way what it used to be like, what happened, what it's like now. So, when I was growing up, I grew up in a really good family. You know, my parents, like, always gave me the things I wanted, and like, my parents, neither one of them ever drank, like, basically in their entire life, so, like, my dad has literally never taken a drink, and my mom hasn't had a drink since I've been alive. But there is alcoholism in my family. So, like, you know, they would always give me warnings, like, you know, you got to be careful. You know, your grandfather's an alcoholic. Your uncle's an alcoholic. So, like, they would always give me these warnings, and I kind of just brushed it off, like, all right, that's not a big deal. So, you know, as I was growing up, even though I had all those things, you know, I had a really good family, a really supportive family, like, I still felt, like, a little bit off, you know, like, and I was doing well in school, like, you know, I was, like, pretty athletic. Like, on the outside, everything seemed like it was okay, but inside, something just felt a little bit off. It wasn't, and, like, I guess the main thing is that I was just always full of fear, you know, like, especially fear of people, which is, you know, pretty amazing that I could get up here now and speak in front of so many people. But, when I was in college, I would, and this is when I was active at this point, I would be, like, so afraid to run into certain people that I would take the stairs up to the 7th floor, which to me is a pretty big deal. But, you know, so, like, I wouldn't take the elevator because I'd be afraid of, like, someone coming out of the elevator and possibly, like, saying hello to me, you know? That's how much, like, fear I was in throughout my entire life. So, when I was 12, I had picked up for the first time. And, I just fell in love with it. Like, I just fell in love with it instantly. You know, I forgot, like, all those things that, you know, my parents had been telling me, all those warnings that they had given me that, you know, like, I need to be careful, you know, that I'm, you know, predisposed to possibly having a problem later on. And, and it talks about, like, in the literature, it says, you know, that, like, one of the things that makes me an alcoholic is having a physical allergy. So, like, for me, you know, even that first night, you know, I didn't go out with the intention of getting, you know, totally wasted. You know, I went out, you know, saying, all right, I'm going to experiment, I'm going to see how it is. But, you know, being like a true alcoholic, I guess, you know, it didn't work out the way I planned. You know, so I ended up passing out at my friend's house. And then that Monday in school, you know, and it also talks about, like, the mental obsession, which is really the bigger of the two problems. Because, you know, if I didn't have that mental obsession, if I wasn't constantly thinking about it, that physical allergy would never, you know, be set in motion. So that Monday in school, you know, after the first day I'd used, so 2 days later, you know, and I had made all these rules beforehand, like, you know, I'm not going to use during the week, I'm not going to use during school, all this stuff, you know, I'm never going to use alone, all these rules that I made before I picked up that first drink, you know. And that day, I ended up buying something off some kid in school, and I went home that night, and, like, the obsession was too great already at that point, and I ended up using, you know, by myself at home, you know, breaking kind of all the boundaries that I had set, or at least a lot of the boundaries I had set. And, you know, that basically just characterized my entire using. You know, I would continually say, like, oh, I don't want to use today, like, or maybe I'd go, like, 2 or 3 days to prove to myself that I wasn't really an alcoholic and that, you know, I could, you know, drink normally, because if I was an alcoholic, I wouldn't be able to stop for 2 days or 3 days, whatever. And, yeah, so basically, you know, and it also talks about in the book, like the bedevilments on page 52, like that part has always just like jumped out to me in terms of like the unmanageability of my life. Because kind of, you know, like as I was a little kid, like how I kind of had that appearance on the outside of everything being okay, that still carried on through like, you know, my active alcoholism. You know, so like I was still doing pretty well in school, and you know, I still had like a few friends here and there, but like I still definitely was in a lot of fear and definitely, you know, nervous and you know, just felt like a little bit off. So yeah, so basically what ended up happening is, you know, like I was saying with the bedevilments, like, you know, I was unhappy, you know, I couldn't have like personal relationships. Like I'd ended up, like my brother's graduation was like one day that really sticks out. Like he was graduating from college, and like, and I told myself, you know, I'm gonna go, I'm gonna support him. And I ended up that morning waking up and like, you know, like kind of faking sick and just telling my parents I couldn't make it, and they kind of let me off, you know, and I ended up using that day and stuff. And like, I guess that's kind of like what was characteristic, is that I continually like hurt people who I cared about, you know. So what ended up happening is, you know, I ended up hurting my parents and my family enough that they had sent me to rehab. And when I was in I was in inpatient rehab for 4 months. And when I was there, like, I learned a lot of really good things, you know. Like, they gave me a lot of information, and like, they would tell me, you know, to go to meetings, get a sponsor, start working the steps, get service commitments. These were all the things that they were telling me, but I only kind of listened to the parts that I liked, you know. So when I got out, I went to meetings. You know, that was one thing I definitely did. So I came out and I went to meetings daily, sometimes 2 times a day, like basically nonstop for about a year. But I didn't take those other suggestions of, you know, getting a sponsor, of starting to work the steps and those types of things. And it started to affect my life because, and, you know, I mean, the book talks about it, but, you know, alcohol was only a symptom of my disease. My problem is myself, you know, and my own character defects and all that stuff. So, you know, all my character defects were still there, at least most of them. You know, I was definitely really dishonest, and, you know, I was still selfish. I was still definitely in a lot of fear and stuff. So when I just lost my train of thought, sorry about that. So I ended up coming to the Atlantic Group because a friend of mine had asked me, like a friend who I had known from school. You know, I didn't know him that well, but like he kind of had what I wanted, even though I may not have known it at the time. So he brought me here, and my, I guess, eventual sponsor was one of the 10-minute speakers. And like, I guess, and it talks about it in the book, you know, it says like, his whole deportment shouts that he's the man with the real answer. And that's like what I wanted, you know. I didn't want to go to a meeting and say like, oh, I'm in so much fear, and someone say, well, you know, go to a meeting and don't pick up. Like, I wanted like a real answer, you know. And that's what I saw in him. So I ended up asking him to be my sponsor. And you know, by asking for help, you know, things started to change. My life started to get better. Basically, I mean, he just started bringing me through the book. And when we go through the book, you know, we go through it line by line. You know, we highlight the things that I find important. I write them in my notebook, and then I write, like, what I identify with in my notebook, and then I look for questions and answers. I define words I don't understand. All these things that I'm just reading the book, you know, really carefully, line by line. And I started taking the actions that the book was telling me to take. You know, it gives you clear-cut directions on what to do. You know, it tells me exactly what I need to do. So if I have a resentment, I could just turn to the book. You know, I open up to the part about resentments, and it will say, you know, put it down on paper, write the causes, see how you were hurt or threatened by. You know, it tells, and then it says to, you know, resolutely look for our own mistakes, you know, to go and see where I was selfish, where I was dishonest, where I was inconsiderate, and all those things. And by doing that, you know, I started getting that freedom, you know? Because I was getting the relief from the meetings, you know? Like, I would go to a meeting and I would feel better. But I didn't have, like, that freedom of mind that I kept on hearing people talk about, you know? And that's what I really wanted, even though I wasn't sure that was what I wanted, you know? I guess there was always, like, I kind of had those reservations in the back of my mind that, like, oh, you know, I could get through this. Like, I'm kind of just doing this to make my parents happy. Maybe when I'm, like, 25 or 30, I'll go back and, you know, use successfully. But, yeah. And it says it in the book, and this is, like, one line that just really, like, just jumps out at me. It says, to be vital, you know, faith must be accompanied by self-sacrifice and unselfish constructive action. And to me, like, in my life today, that's, like, the part that really sticks out to me. Because even back when I was using, I always had that faith. You know, I always believed that there was a power greater than me, and I always believed that there was God. But I just didn't know how to form a relationship with him. And, you know, by doing this work and by taking those right actions, you know, and by, like, the unselfish constructive actions, you know, it's calling people, asking how their day is going. All right, thanks. And, yeah, well, I guess time's up. But, yeah, there's a lot of things I want to say. But basically, you know, today God has really, like, given me a new way of life and just the happiness, peace, and freedom that I'm truly grateful for. So thank you.
Our second 10-minute speaker is our very own Rose.
Hi, I'm Rose. I'm an alcoholic. I'm really nervous. You know, today I can recognize that that's fear, address it, and move on. A couple of years ago, I just couldn't do that. I would have probably thrown up on my shoes and run out the door and never come back again. So that's progress, not perfection. My home group is the Atlantic Group. My sponsor is Liz. I got sober February 26, 2004, and I'm working on step 9. So those are the vital statistics. Clutching my water as if this is going to save me. I grew up in an alcoholic household. That didn't make me an alcoholic, but it certainly taught me a few things earlier than I think otherwise. I am one of 5 kids. You heard my darling brother speak last week, and you know, it's really been a great gift to walk in this program with him and with everybody else. You know, I had a great family. I love them. They're wonderful. They taught me a lot of really amazing things. Wonderful parents that taught me to be honest and truthful and to work hard. And, you know, some of the things I learned on my own were to lie and to cheat and to steal and to be lazy. So, alcohol was always around, but my first drunk was, I remember it very clearly, unfortunately. I was in high school. It was the high school dance. Sophomore year, had a thing for Brad, and I got all dolled up for the dance. I had my, you know, pink corduroy skirt on, and my, I don't know if you remember in the 80s, there was this fashion where you wore 2 socks and white Keds, and I was styling, and I showed up at the dance, and Brad was dancing with another girl, and I was crushed. It was awful. So I did what every other heartbroken teenager does. I went home. I took one of the Biersteins, and we had lived in Germany, so the ones we had were like that big, about a foot tall. And I went to the bar, and I filled it with all sorts of different liquors from the liquor cabinet. And I drank a good portion of it. I didn't drink all of it. I probably would have died, but I drank a good amount of it. And the next morning, I felt like I wanted to die. But what that did for me was it made me forget about Brad. I didn't, you know, I felt very poorly in the morning. And that pain sort of filled up that God-sized hole. You know, I said, he doesn't deserve me. And I moved on. We moved around a bit as a family. And it wasn't until my junior year in high school that my drinking really took off. We lived on this beautiful little island in the South Pacific, and off a military base, and military service members can buy alcohol at 18. So very quickly, we, you know, I found the crowd that had the friends that could buy the booze, and we would regularly go down to the beach and booze. Boone's Farm was the drink of choice at that time. So had a really good time, and it worked really well. You know, I was getting in trouble. I was lying. I was sneaking out, but I wasn't really feeling the consequences of my drinking. It wasn't until I got to college, and again, it wasn't unmanageable, but I was still dealing with pain, fear, and anxiety with the drink. It really took kind of a dark turn when my father died in a car accident. The way I handled it was I went out and got really drunk for a really long time and then decided that I was going to get back together with a boyfriend and then I was going to leave the country because this was just too much for me to handle. So I went to study abroad for a semester. And that's another sort of facet to my alcoholism is I get myself into trouble and then I leave. What's often referred to as a geographic. If you're new, you may hear people talk about geographics. Well, I decided that Japan was good and far enough away, so I went there. But the problem is I came with me. So I found the crowd that drank really heavily. I got involved in dishonest relationships, and nothing changed. Came back, graduated from college again, didn't really feel the effects. Left, got a job, was drinking socially, work in the financial services industry. They drink a lot. And that was perfect for me. Again, not really feeling the effects of my alcoholism. I wasn't getting arrested. I wasn't, you know, none of that. Thank you. Didn't lose a job, didn't lose family, didn't lose. But what was happening is that my world was getting smaller and smaller. And so instead of building lasting relationships, I was, my friends were in a number of different crowds so that nobody could really tell how much I drank. I'd start off the evening with one group, I'd move to another, then I'd move to another. Nobody really saw the problem, and I didn't really either. I didn't think it was a problem. Got to the point where my world was really the, you know, four walls of my bedroom, and actually came into the program because you know, my brother had experience with the program. We went in together. I knew I was an alcoholic. I threw that term out a lot. I'm an alcoholic, leave me alone. My dad was a drunk, leave me alone. You know, that, but I didn't really know what it meant. I knew that I didn't have the switch, though. When I started drinking, I couldn't turn it off. I might have, or I couldn't tell. You know, I might go out and have a few beers, but more often than not, I was at that stage, I was drinking to oblivion. So came into AA, and actually, you know, I was really blessed to come to this group right away. We just sort of stumbled upon it and started coming back to the Thursday night beginners meeting, which is just amazing, and this Tuesday night group. Right away met some people that really just, you know, walked the walk. Met the woman who is to become my sponsor, my beautiful sponsor, Liz, who really just, you know, asked me how I was doing. And I said, fine, I'm fine, I'm fine. I wasn't fine, and through, you know, talking with her and really learning about what this program is, I learned so much about myself. I learned that, you know, the alcohol wasn't my problem, it was my solution. And you take away the alcohol, I'm left with this awful mess. And, you know, I realized very early on through working the steps how fear just ran my life every step of the way. It's funny, I heard, you hear people identify and you go, yeah, I did that too. I heard Ava talk about being on the bus and going past her stop because she couldn't call out, you know, back door. I couldn't do that either. And I was amazed that other people had that same problem or that same issue. Fear was really, you know, really ruining my life. And I saw it very clearly in step four. You know, if you're new, jump into the steps, jump into the program, find somebody you trust to take you through them. There are a lot of them in this room. When I went through step four and I wrote out my resentments and I saw what my part was and what was driving it, it was the character defect, it was all fear. And I've learned one day at a time, you know, how to address that, how to be, you know, sober and not live a life based on fear. And the reward is just more than I could have ever imagined. I went from a life that was the four walls of my bedroom to, you know, an amazing career that I never really wanted. I'm getting married in a month to an amazing man that I just love dearly, and we're moving to London in January, and all these doors are opening, you know, that I never, I'd still be in my bedroom drinking. So for me, you know, the gift of the program is I've learned how to live life as, you know, a sober, responsible woman, not driven on and by fear, and really try and give back all the things that have been given to me. I have two amazing, wonderful sponsees that are just a joy to work with, and I thank them every day for what they do for me. You know, I heard somebody say, you know, we'll learn to love you, we'll love you until you can learn to love someone else. And that's really been very powerful for me because, you know, this isn't a self-help program in the sense that, you know, it's to really keep your sobriety, to keep on that center beam. You've got to help somebody else and get out of yourself. You have to find a higher power that's greater than yourself, that you can turn over your problems and your issues to. That's been really helpful for me when I'm afraid. You know, I call them the HP or God. I don't know what to do here. Help me out. And then I move on. I don't have to sort everything out in my head. You know, for me, my disease has really centered in the mind. It's a disease of perception. And I need you all in this program every day to remind me that I'm not the highest power. And for that, I thank you very much.
Our main speaker tonight is Terry. Hi, my name is Terry. I'm an alcoholic. And for me, only sober through the grace of God, the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I always say that because when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I did not have a desire to be sober. I knew nothing about sobriety. I wanted the pain to stop. The miracle, the grace of God, is I made my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I haven't had a drink since that first meeting. Never been in the treatment center, never been in the detox. I'd never been to an AA meeting before that. I knew very little about AA. The only thing I knew about AA is what I saw on television. Days of Wine and Roses, The Lost Weekend, She'll Cry Tomorrow, where people were drunk. So I knew that was where people went who wanted to stop drinking. My problem is I never wanted to stop drinking, so why would I come to Alcoholics Anonymous? And I was so fortunate and blessed because when I came to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, people were here. They kept the doors open. The coffee was on. People got up here. They told this story just like we did tonight, the three speakers we have. And I listened, and I identified with every word they said in terms of the identification of being about being an alcoholic. I knew I was an alcoholic by the time I was 18 years of age. I started drinking at 16. By the time I was 18, I was in a world of trouble. But I drank for 18 more years because I liked what booze did for me. I liked the way I felt. I liked the way it went down. Liked everything about it. I didn't like the consequences a lot of the times, but I was willing to pay the price. The unacceptable became acceptable. And when I showed up at Alcoholics Anonymous, I was 36 years of age. Blackouts were constant, gray outs. I didn't know what was going to happen when I pick up the first drink. I could drink all night. I could have two or three drinks and go into a blackout and wind up some jam, a jackpot, and get up the next day and be full of guilt, shame, and remorse and swear I'd never do it again. But I had no defense against the first drink. You know, I'd go home and I get up and I can't do this anymore. I got to stop. And somewhere along the line, the next day, it wouldn't be quite as bad. Or the day after, people wouldn't be, I'd look at it differently. And I wind up picking up the drink. It was right back to square one. You know, I love geographics. I love when Rose said in Germany and the Caribbean. I'm 56 years of age. I'll be 57. I'm going to give you 56 years of geographics. I was born and raised on 4th Street and 2nd Avenue. I moved to 3rd Street and 1st Avenue, and now I'm back on 4th Street and 2nd Avenue. That's 56 years. Three street corners in Manhattan in 56 years. So that's my geographics, you know, and... As a kid growing up, you know, I've been to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings all over. I mean, I always identify when people get up here and talk about drinking, tell their story. I always get identification out of it. You know, and as a kid growing up, I was always uncomfortable in my own skin. I don't know why that is. My father and mother were both on the other side, both from Ireland. My mother was one of 17. My father was one of 16. They came over to the country off the boat. It was just, you know, and they worked hard. But my father was an alcoholic. My father was a drunk. And when my father picked up a drink, you never knew what was going to happen at the house, you know. And my fondest memories of my father, and I could see him today. He'd be sitting at the kitchen table in our little tenement apartment. And he would have a six-pack of Rheingold, a fifth of Fleischmann's, three packs of Pall Mall, and I knew at the end of the night there was a possibility the cops would be at the house. Because all bets were off when he drank. But when he didn't drink, he was quiet as a mouse. He was great in aspect. But when he picked up a drink, he was just off to the races. So I saw a lot of alcoholism in him. You know, I remember being in the schoolyard, you know, and somebody would come and get me and say to me, I mean, I'm playing ball, and somebody would say, your father's laying in the gutter. Can you pick him up? And I go and pick him up and take him home. And, he threw up on himself, and he made a mess of himself, and taking him upstairs, washing him off, and putting him in the bed, and going back to the schoolyard. You know, kids could be cruel, and they're making fun of my father and everything else. And before I know it, I'm fighting with him and screaming at him. And then I go home, and I say to my mother, he always embarrasses me. He always does. I really believed in my mind that he was doing this to me. It took me coming to Alcoholics Anonymous to realize he was an alcoholic, and when he picked up a drink, all bets were off, and he wasn't doing it to me. He was just a drunk, you know. And as a kid growing up, I grew up in a neighborhood when, you know, it's much different today than it was back then, but as a kid growing up in the 50s and 60s on 4th Street and 2nd Avenue, the men's shelter was in full swing. The Bowery was in full swing. I was right around the corner from the Bowery to full, you know. I go around the corner, right around the block, and there'd be 200-300 guys waiting at the men's shelter to get a meal. Back then, there was only one shelter in the city of New York. If you're a homeless guy, he was on 83rd Street. There was tons of flop houses and people hanging on the corners, drunk, laying down, passed out. So as a kid growing up, I saw a lot of that stuff. And I remember I'd come down the hallway and I'd go to school in the morning, and some guy would be passed out in the hallway. And I said to my mother, why is he there? She said he chose to be there. So for a very long period of time, I thought it was a personal choice. And I realized coming to Alcoholics Anonymous that when you're an alcoholic and you pick up a drink, all choice goes. And as a kid growing up down there, also, you know, you sit on the stoop and you're out there, and all of a sudden you start talking to some of these guys, and you realize a lot of them were very bright, articulate men. But they were alcoholics, and they left their families. They drank everything out. They had no place else to go. And when you had no place else to go back then, you can go down in the Bowery and get a flop for 75 cents a night. A lot of them were World War II veterans and Korean War veterans. And you go down there and you talk to these guys, and they just gave up. They gave up on life, and that's where they wound up, you know. And they wait for their Social Security disability check, or they work some transient jobs of being a mover, day-to-day checks, and then go to the bar and drink it all up, and then pass out in the flop and do it all over again. And a friend of mine's grandfather, as I was a kid growing up, his father owns a joint right on the corner of 3rd Street and 3rd Avenue. It was a Bowery bar, and you walk in there, and it'd be 40, 50 guys in there, all coming from the flop houses who were just in there drinking. They love kids. So when we walked in there, they put us up on the chair and buy us a Coke and give us some money. They just love kids, you know. But you look in the corner and you see people passed out at the table with their heads down, or you see people shaking so bad, or people be just, you know, and go outside, you walk a half a foot away from the bar, and all of a sudden some guy would be laying in the street. So I saw all that alcoholism. It didn't mean anything to me. My father's alcoholism didn't mean anything to me. The only thing it meant was he embarrassed me in front of a lot of people. But I never thought about it, you know. And as a kid growing up also, I was one of those kids, you know, we hear a lot now these days, and kids that don't do well in school. And I was one of those kids. I just didn't do well in school. I was very uncomfortable in school, didn't like school. Went to parochial school for a bunch of years, and they started to leave me back, and they wanted to leave me back again. And so finally they talked to my mother, and they said to her, can you take him out of here, put him in public school. And I went to the public school system, and I ran rampant in the public school system. I was just all over the place, you know. I wasn't a bad kid, but it was just all over the place. You know, if I was supposed to be in the cafeteria, I was in the gymnasium. If I was supposed to be in a class, I was in the cafeteria. Did all the stuff, you know, never did homework, never showed up. Was one of those half a wise guys that always wanted to hang out. And I looked at it back this day, and I was just, I just couldn't do the work. And my way of acting out was I would just act out. I'd be the clown. I'd be the tough guy. I'd be running around. Then eventually I started hanging out in front of the school, didn't even bother going in, you know. And as a kid growing up also, I had a bad skin condition. I used to grow cysts on my face and pimples, you know. And it always, as a kid, I always felt like an ugly duckling in that aspect. I would go to the doctor, and they would shoot needles into my face to knock the cysts down. I had pimples. I always felt self-conscious, uncomfortable, between that and not reading well and not spelling well and not doing the work and not doing any of that stuff, I was just very uncomfortable. The only place I was really good at, and you know, and I don't think it's uncommon, I've heard many stories and qualifications, people who latch on to certain areas of their life. I latched on to sports. I was a terrific basketball player and a terrific baseball player. That's what I was. I put all my effort into it. I was very good at it. I played on many teams. I always did well. And I remember one time I was in a CYO league, and the coach called me into the office with the two guys who were coaches on different high school teams, and they wanted to give me a scholarship to go to their high school. Two parochial high schools, good basketball high schools in terms of that. And they said, "Can you just bring your report card in? We'd love to consider you for a scholarship." You know, and I walked out of that room, and I said to myself, I ain't telling anybody at all about this, because I couldn't bring my report card in because I had all Fs and failures. I had a fourth grade reading level. I was so embarrassed by it, and I walked out and I pretended like it never happened, just like it never happened. And I didn't say another word to anybody for years about that. I didn't go home and tell anybody I got offered these opportunities. I just didn't continue on my merry way, you know. But I excelled in those areas, and what happened for me was at the age of 16 years of age, I was down in schoolyard. I don't know if I ever drank before that. I don't have any recollection of sipping my father's drinks or any of this stuff like that. I just don't remember it. As I look back in my childhood, the way it was, I just don't remember a lot of stuff, and that's way before I drank. I was oblivious to a lot of stuff. At the age of 16, I was down in schoolyard one day, and we were playing ball, and it was a hot day. And some kid came out with a couple of beers, and he said, "You want a beer?" And I said, "Yes." I don't know why I said yes that day. I'm sure I was asked that question before, and people were drinking before. But I said yes. And I picked up the couple of beers, and I heard it in AA, and I hear it all the time. It's the magic licks. I just felt different. All of a sudden, I had a couple of beers. The world was at ease. I wasn't stupid anymore. I wasn't ugly anymore. I didn't have to. You know, I was just. I felt more comfortable. I felt like the whole weight of the world came off my shoulders. I sat down, and that was the best night of my life. At that point, it was the best night of my life. And I remember going home, and I said, "I love to do this. I'm going to do this as often as I can." 3 weeks later, I quit school. I got a full-time job. And I always worked. There wasn't a lot of money in the household. So as a kid growing up, I shined shoes, delivered newspapers, did a lot of the stuff that people do back then to kind of get some extra money to do some of the stuff they do, buy the sneakers. I remember buying my first pair of Converse sneakers after shining shoes, $5.75. I can remember like it was yesterday. I went into this place on Avenue B, bought my first pair of Converse sneakers because all the kids had Converse sneakers. At the age of 16, I quit school. I got a full-time job. I walked into that bar, a neighborhood bar, at the age of 16 years of age. They all knew my father. Back then, it was very much a neighborhood. Nobody said a word. I sat in the corner. I said to the bartender, "Give everybody a drink." I threw a $20 bill up in the bar. And as Bill talks about in his story, how he hit Wall Street, he had arrived. I arrived that day. I walked into that bar that day and picked up that drink and gave everybody a drink. I was a big shot. I felt everything was, it was great. I came out of that bar 20 years later. I went in 16, and when I came out of that bar, I was 36 years of age. 20 years later, a lot of drinking. By the time I started drinking at the age of 16, by the time I was 18, I was a full-blown alcoholic. You know, and I was in a world of trouble already, blackouts, grayouts. One of the things I identified when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, we have a lot of new people. I always identified when somebody said, you know, every time I drank, I didn't get in trouble. But every time I got in trouble, I was drinking. That was true in my case. Every time I went out, I didn't get in trouble. But every time I wound up with a pair of handcuffs on, doing the unacceptable thing, in a fight, the key element to the entire thing is I was drinking. And I needed to hear that when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, that it was about the first drink, you know. And I look back, and people talk about social drinking and having periods of time when they didn't drink. I don't know anything about social drinking. I've never been a social drinker. When I pick up the first drink, I always drink as much as I can, as often as I can. The only thing that stops me, if the bar's closed, if I run out of money, if I pass out, or if something happens and I can't drink anymore, fights, or I get locked up or something, like that's what stops me from drinking. Otherwise, I don't stop. And that was the way it was the first day I drank till when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I had a lot of stuff in that mix, you know. At the age of 18 years of age, I remember it was a Saturday morning, and I was already in a world of trouble. I was getting in jackpots. I was getting jammed up a little bit. And I was drinking a lot of booze, and I walk into some bar, and I'm sitting there at 11:30 in the morning. I'm 18 years of age with a baseball cap on backwards, watching a black and white television set. And I'm waiting for the ball game to come on. And some guy says to me, Terry, you know what your problem is? And I said to him, what's my problem? He says, you got to stay away from that hard booze and start drinking more beer. When you drink booze, you get crazy. Now, I don't know why. In my whole entire life, many people tried to help me. Many people told me a lot of things. You know, the two things I remember is that guy telling me that and me thinking that was the best thing I've ever heard in my life. So for the next many years, I drank a lot of beer. The other thing I remember is my father telling me, Terry, don't ever trust anybody that don't drink. Now, he's an alcoholic. Don't ever test. Now, I took that with gospel. Now, he told me to go to school. He told me to get an education. He told me a lot of wonderful things. I didn't listen to one iota that my parents ever said to me. But my father said, don't trust anybody that don't drink. I took that as gospel. And some guy at a bar at 11 o'clock in the morning watching a Charlie Chan movie tells me, you need to drink beer. Stay away from the booze. You'll be okay. So I drank a lot of beer, and it was off to the races, and it was the same thing. If I sat up here and told you every time I drank, my life was miserable, my life was horrible, it would be a lie. I had a lot of good times drinking. I had a lot of fun drinking. But I also got to be very honest with myself and realize that I also had a lot of trouble drinking. You know, blackouts, the grayouts, the unacceptable behavior, being asked to leave bars. You know, you walk into a bar one night, you remember you're out drinking, the next night you remember, and then all of a sudden you go to the bar and the guy says to me, not tonight, Terry, I don't need it. Puts his finger up, you can't come in here tonight. You know what you did last night? I didn't know what I did last night because I was in a half a blackout or a grayout. And he said to me, look, please don't come in here. I don't need the aggravation, go somewhere else. You know, and my attitude was, well, I'll go somewhere else and drink somewhere else. But, you know, at the bottom of my heart, I felt bad. I mean, I didn't want to be thrown out of that bar. Some guy putting his finger up telling me not to come in. Or somebody taking me on the side telling me the inappropriate stuff I did last night or what I said to this person or what I did. You know, and I'm one of those alcoholics. I'm full of guilt, shame, and remorse. And the stuff killed me. And the only answer to that stuff was to continue drinking. Because when I had a couple of drinks in me, I just didn't care, you know. The big book talks about being selfish, you know, and I think as I got more and more sober in my sobriety, I realized I'm a very selfish alcoholic. When I pick up a drink, all bets are off, you know. I run through people's lives. If you're in my way, you get run over. You know, when I came in AA and people said to me, well, are you selfish? I said, no, I'm not selfish. People would die. I would pay my respects. I would go to the funeral parlor. I would do all these things. I thought that was not being selfish. Meanwhile, as soon as I went to the funeral, I walked away. I never ever thought about giving the person a phone call. I never thought about doing any of that stuff because it was all about me. You know, when I started, even before I wasn't drinking, it was just about me. And I ran through people's lives. I went over to Europe, and it's kind of a funny story. Back in the early 70s, around 71 or 72, a friend of mine said, you want to go to Europe for 17 days? I'm going to book this package. I said, yeah, I'll go with you. So we went over to Europe, went over 17 days, went to four countries. And I know I was there because I got pictures to prove it. Very little recollection of any of it. I went over there, and all I wanted to do was drink my way right through the entire thing. When I'm over there, I'm on this tour, and I meet a woman who from the west side of Manhattan, 78th Street. And she was Irish, and she drank just like me. And, you know, we hit it off pretty good, and we drank the entire 21 days or 17 days, and we come back, and we started going out together, and she drank just like probably worse than me. And we just hooked right up, and we were going out, we were dating, and then we got engaged, and we're going to do all this. I remember going to Christmas parties at a house, and her family drank, and I thought my father and mother would be ecstatic the fact I married an Irish girl, you know. But I got to go over all the way to Europe to find somebody from 78th Street who's an alcoholic who drinks just like me. And this went on for years in the drinking. We drank at each other, we drank towards each other, we drank with each other and against each other. And it was really insane. I mean, it was insane drinking when I tell you I'd be running down Broadway at 2 o'clock in the morning, drunk out of my mind with a pint of vodka. She'd be chasing me. It was nuts. And what happened was, at some point, we had an argument. And here's the alcoholic. I had an argument with somebody I was going to marry, that I must have really cared for it at some point because I asked her to marry me. And we had an argument outside the Beacon Theater at 11 o'clock on a Friday night. That was 34 years ago. She said to me, don't ever talk to me again. I said, don't ever talk to me again. I ain't seen her in 34 years. That's just an alcoholic. I just never thought about it. I walked away, walked out of there like it never even happened, went down to the bar and continued to drink. I've always had jobs. I made a lot of money in my life, spent every dime I ever had. And I finally, at 4 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the morning, and about 30 years ago, a little over 30 years ago, I met my wife. I'll be married 30 years this November. I met her at the Park Inn Tavern by Thompson Square Park at 3:30 in the morning. We have two different stories. She's in AA, I'm in NA, AA. My story is I walked in there 3:30 in the morning drunk. She was bending over the shuffleboard machine, throwing the puck down. I fell in love. You know, typical alcoholic, took me 10 minutes to fall in love. I fell in love. We moved in together, and we got married a couple of months later. I'm going to be married 30 years this November. And she has a different story. She said I was sitting there drunk, grunting at her. And so I'm here to tell you that my story's correct. So if she ever thought... But it was just that way. And then we started drinking, and it was off the races. We both drank with each other, against each other. Same stuff as before. The only difference was I was getting older. I was getting sicker and sicker. She got some surgery. She couldn't drink the way I was drinking. And I'm an alcoholic. When I pick the first drink up, I don't know what's going to happen. She see me on a Thursday night. She said, "Terry, where are you going?" I said, "I'm going to the bar. I'm going to go watch the Yankee game. I'm going to have a couple of drinks, and I'll be home." I come home Saturday, Sunday. Because when I picked that first drink up, all bets were off. I remember she would say to me when I come home, "Terry, you could have called." You know, I sit there. And she said, "I was really concerned about you because I really care for you. And my attitude is don't care so much. Being half a tough guy." And I knew she was right. That guilt, shame, and remorse said right in. She was entitled to that phone call. And I say to her, "Babe, I promise you I'll make the phone call next time." Well, if I picked up a drink tonight and went out drinking tonight, I wouldn't call her tonight. Almost 20 years later. I'm sober 19 years last month. I would not call her because that's the way I am. When I start drinking, nothing gets in the way. I'll worry about it tomorrow. Whatever price tag I got to pay, I'm willing to pay. This went on, and I went to work for the city and got a good job with the city, and I'm still working with the city now 24 years later, and I was off to the races, driving around city of New York with a sanitation truck, drunk as a skunk, blackouts, grayouts. I mean, I parked the sanitation truck one day. We were in the bar drinking. I was so drunk that somebody must have told the boss, "Hey, this guy's in the bar. Hey, these two guys are in the bar drunk. Somebody better go get the truck." They come out, and the truck is gone. I get on the phone. I'm sitting in a bar at 11:30 at night. I'm supposed to be back at 11:30, and I call up and tell them they stole the truck. The guy's screaming at me on the phone. He says, "You better get back here." So I take a cab back to the garage. It turned out somebody picked the truck up. But my attitude is somebody stole the truck. But I was so drunk, I couldn't even stand up. I had many of those times. Only by the grace of God, I look at an AA that I haven't killed somebody behind the wheel of a car. And for me, what happened was I went on with this job. I got locked up one night on St. Mark's Place. I was passed out. I was 20 years drunk. I went to a bachelor's party all day. And I just passed out behind the wheel. And a guy pulls me out, a cop, and says to me, "Have you been drinking?" I was whacked. I said, "Whacked out of my mind." He said to me, "I need my license. I work for the city." And he said to me, "Today's your lucky day." It was in April of 88. He said, "Today's your lucky day." He said, "I don't need the overtime." Drives back to my house, takes the keys, throws them in the back seat, locks the door. I go upstairs. I was four guys that day. It wasn't even my car. It was somebody else's car. Everybody's missing. They're calling all over. Four guys and me, everybody's gone. Nobody knows. Nobody goes home. Everybody's disappeared. And I call my house looking for these guys. And I get up the next day and I told my wife, "I can't do this no more." She's not talking to me now, barely. And what happened for me was I went over to East. I heard about AA and I knew about AA, but I didn't know anything about it other than the fact that I saw it on television. So I went to East West Bookstore and I bought a Stop Drinking tape. And I put it in a Walkman. I put some headphones on my head and I walk around for 8 weeks, 6 weeks, with subliminal messages and waves going. And I'm here to tell you that fear keeps you sober so long. Fear kept me sober for 6 weeks. I was sober for 6 weeks. Never had a drink for 6 weeks. And it was the longest in my life. I do all the things that alcoholics do when they don't stop drinking. They got no program. I started working out. I started running. I wanted to become a vegetarian. I was in the gymnasium, pumping, doing all this stuff, getting back. I'm going to get back in shape. But I wasn't dealt with my alcoholism at all. And I thought if I did all these other things, I would feel better. And at the end of the six-week period, I don't know if it's a Tuesday or Wednesday morning, 6 o'clock in the morning, I'm working with a guy, and the guy says, "What do you want to drink?" I said, "Give me a can of Budweiser." I pick up that can of Budweiser at 6 o'clock in the morning while I'm working. I don't know why I said, "Give me a can of Budweiser." Next thing I know, it's a couple of weeks later. I've been drinking steady for the next 4 or 5 weeks or 6 weeks, whatever it was, around the clock as much as I could. I run a car into the wall, not even my car. I have a lot of car stories, and none of the cars were mine, right? And what happened was I get out of the car, and I just can't do this anymore. And I go home, and I'm drinking on top of the car. And I get up the next day. I go to the EAU for the Department of Sanitation. The guy says to me, fills out a questionnaire. The guy says, "You're an alcoholic." I said, "I knew that when I was 18. I'm 36 years of age now." He said, "I want you to go to detox rehab." I said, "Not going." He said, "Why not?" He said, "Because we always made fun of guys going to the farm. They're going to pick apples. Misery loves company. My pride and my arrogance wouldn't allow me to go." Guy said, "I can't do anything about it." I went to my friend. He said, "Come back here at 3 or 4 o'clock. There's a meeting today." There's a meeting downtown. It was in the meeting book called Clean Sweep. And it was all sanitation guys that came back from the farm. And it was 30 of us sitting in this room downtown on Lafayette Street. It was actually in the meeting book, and people would come up, and we'd be there, and a lot of disgruntled people. And I went to the meeting, and they gave me a meeting book, and I went to another meeting on the outside. I started going to some different meetings. It was always uncomfortable in AA. And I remember I went to a bunch of meetings. I would come to a meeting like this, and I see people dressed in ties and jackets, and I just couldn't take it. I sat in the back, didn't want to talk to anybody. I heard speakers talk about sponsorship. People said, you got to get a sponsor, get a home group, get a sponsor, do some service. I heard all that stuff. And I was so frightened of everything, fear in my life, I just couldn't do it. I just couldn't do it. And I sat there and I went to three meetings a day and I wasn't drinking. Went on for a while, you know. But the miracle, and it's an open meeting, the miracle for me, there's a lot of new people here tonight, was I sat here long enough to hear my story. And I didn't believe when people said to me, if you don't pick the first drink up, you can't get drunk. The importance of coming to meetings, the importance of getting a sponsor. And I believed every word they said. I wasn't somebody who had fought the program in that aspect. But I wasn't getting a sponsor because I didn't want to disappoint them again because I was going to drink again. In reality, I was so afraid of everything. And what happened for me that day is about 60 days sober, I went to a bunch of meetings. And a guy at the 1 o'clock meeting at Living Now said to me, you have a sponsor? I said, no. He said, I'll be your sponsor. I said, okay. And I spent the next 5 years, the guy sponsored me, took me through the steps. But what he did was he asked me to call him every day, make that phone call. And back in my mind, when he asked me that and I was in a coffee shop with him, I said, I don't call anybody every day. Now, I wasn't saying this to him. Because I was having conversations in my own head. Somebody would ask him. I would answer it, but I would answer it in my own head, not out verbally. And he said to me, Terry, the reason I'd like you to have you call me every day, in case you feel like picking up a drink, you'll pick up the phone. Little simple things. He said to me, you know, you make a meeting a day, pick a home group, get a home group, and do some service, you know. And, you know, those are the simple things. 19 years later, those are the things that still work for me today. Staying close to the program, getting a home group, getting a spot. You know, we talked about higher powers. I used to hear many years ago back, I had a tough time with God. I went to parochial school. I got a bunch of priests in the family. I had all these preconceived notions of what God was and what he was doing to me. And it took me to clear up Alcoholics Anonymous, realize God did nothing to me. It was my perception. I wanted to drink, hang out, get drunk, and do all the things that we do when we're young and foolish and drunk. I wanted to do that rather than be involved with God. And so the first 3 years in the program, I used Good Orderly Direction Group of Drunks. But they said to me, no matter what you believe, it's okay. Just believe that you believe. And I started going to meetings on a constant basis, started talking to a sponsor. He took me through the steps. My first sponsor was a guy by the name of Joe A. He died 5.5 years into sobriety. He was HIV positive when he came into the program. He was the best guy I ever met in my life. He did nothing but spend time with me. He shared his experience, strength, and hope. He took me through the steps. He was the most gentle, loving human being. Even in this time when he was really struggling back in the 80s and early 90s when the virus was running rampant, he always had time to talk to me. He never complained. No matter what happened, he never complained about the situation he was in. He was just a grateful alcoholic, you know. He spent a lot of time with me. I'll never forget Joe because he carried me for the first 5 years in this program, you know. And he got me involved in service, and I started doing stuff with the group, and I started doing coffee and chairing meetings and doing that. And I had some great service opportunities in AA. I love what Ron said when he talked about this stuff because it's so important in Alcoholics Anonymous. There's a responsibility with being sober. I can sit here and tell you how wonderful my life is and all the toys I got in my life and all the stuff I got, but there's a responsibility that goes with it. Bill's very clear in the concepts and a lot of his writings about responsibility. You have responsibility when you get sober to carry the message that was so freely given to you. Had the opportunity to get involved in many service commitments. I became the GSR. I became a DCM. And they're not jobs I wanted. I did them because somebody said to me, Terry, this is the next step in the process. And I did them, and I just did the best I could. I got a service sponsor. I got other people in my life. It opened up my life. I became a panel 53 delegate to the General Service Conference. And when I share that, I just share that as an experience. There's only 93 delegates in the United States and Canada. I represented Southeast New York all the way from Staten Island all the way to Montauk out to Suffolk County to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous and do the work that needs to be done, the business aspect of the spiritual program that needs to be done to carry the message. And I remember sitting at the General Service Conference, sitting there on a Tuesday day, looking around the room and saying to myself, how does a drunk from the Lower East Side that quit school in the ninth grade, that was drunk for 20 years, sitting at the 53rd General Service Conference doing the business of Alcoholics Anonymous? It's only the grace of God. It wasn't my goal to do that. I just did the next thing that was in front of me. I showed up a day at a time. I put one foot in front of the other foot. I went to meetings. I put the steps in my life. I got a higher power. Finally, after 3.5 years, I got a God of my understanding, a God I'm very comfortable with today. It's my concept of God. I went back to my religion. I'm really comfortable with it today. All these things just helped me stay away from a drink one day at a time. And I need to be very mindful of that stuff. And when I was at that conference, I sat there and I was doing the business with people I'd never met before, a lot of them. And we were all there for one purpose, to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. So when the next suffering drink comes into alcohol, drunk comes into Alcoholics Anonymous, that the message will be here just as clear as it was for me today when I showed up at Alcoholics Anonymous. People told me the truth in AA. They didn't lie to me. They said, if you don't pick the first drink up, you can't get drunk. If you put these steps in your life and you live one day at a time and do the best you can, you're going to be okay. I went on blind faith, and I tell you, years later, that still works for me, you know. But I need to come here and constantly remind. I need to do some service. I need to ask help from a higher power. I need to have a sponsor. All these simple little things are just as important today as they were the day I walked into this program. And whatever I got today is a direct result of the grace of God and Alcoholics Anonymous. Left up to my own device, I'd still be sitting in that bar thinking the world had treated me badly and how bad my life was. And if you only had this situation, if you only were me. One of the great gifts I was given in Alcoholics Anonymous, one of the great gifts is when I woke up one day, I realized I was a garden variety alcoholic. My story is no different than anybody else in AA. We all have different wrinkles. We all have different twists to it. The bottom line to the story is the booze stopped working. And I couldn't stop drinking, and there was no power in this world that was going to stop me from drinking when I wanted to drink. I came to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Some guy gets up here and tells his story. 19 years later, I haven't had a drink. I can't figure that out. I know it was only the grace of God, people in Alcoholics Anonymous, the steps, the traditions and the concepts, the people that kept the doors open so when a guy like me walked in here and didn't know what to do, had no idea how to stop drinking, somebody told me, if you don't pick the first drink up and you put the steps in your life, you're going to be okay. That's a simple message, and it's just as simple as today was the day that Bill went to visit Dr. Bob in 1935. And as far as I'm concerned, AA hasn't changed one iota. Still one drunk chair with another drunk, how do you stay sober one day at a time? I've never had it so good today. Direct result of Alcoholics Anonymous, the grace of God. People like you who let me know a day at a time, if I don't pick that first drink up and I stay close to the program and I do the service and I take the responsibility to carry this message, I'm going to be okay. I thank everybody for listening. Thank you for inviting me to Helen, and thank you, Atlanta.